Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 67, where Tom, Pedro, Greta, and Catherine are discussing Andrew Abbott's classic book from 1989, The System of Professions, an essay on the division of expert labor. Part 2 applies Abbott's framework to his case on the information professions, which we will extend to contemporary professional work. If you missed part one, you can access it on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. What we want to do is take a look at one of Abbott's cases, because he gives three really excellent case studies. One of them really speaks to us as educators and academics, and that's the one on information professions. And let me just kind of talk about what he's trying to do. He's trying to demonstrate how the system of professions work. This is not just the development, the professionalization, the establishment of the work, the claims of jurisdiction, but also then how different professions start to rise, compete against each other, and some of them lose their domains. We're focusing for this episode more on the intra-professional aspects, the professionalization and the establishment of the claims. Now, what he does here is he takes a very, very broad category of the professions associated with the handling of information. That is, its organization, its presentation, its accessibility, accessibility within the profession itself, and accessibility to others. And so it covers a wide range of professions. But what he does in the case, which I thought was really interesting, was to break the professions down into sort of two general categories: those that handle qualitative information, and those that handle quantitative information, because they evolved and formed at very, very different times and in very, very different ways. And the qualitative, his focus is a lot on the establishment of the librarian profession, although there's others that come into it. And then on the quantitative side, a lot of it, like in the United States, we would know them as operations research systems analysts, or ORSAs, and others who basically become the masters of huge amounts of data. You know, the professions where statistics comes from, both descriptive and inferential statistics and all that. And so that was the quantitative side. Let me just open the floor for initial impressions or things you saw in the case that were really interesting.
I think what is interesting, I think analytically and in a broader scale, just beyond just information of the case and the application, so to speak, is that it really brings to light, I think, one of the key ideas in the book. You know, we talked about in the part one, who is about writing this book too, and how he's trying to move the literature. And this was very much a watershed kind of work. And I think here we can see the attention exactly to the more dynamic, processual, concrete stories of these dynamics. And in particular, we see here in this case, is this effort to try to move beyond types of reification. Because while he's trying to tell the story from the point of view of the jurisdiction, so the space in which the different groups bring their potential solutions and ideas, but trying to recognize that this space in itself perpetually moving and being continuously constructed, because the very idea that different groups bring to how information should be handled, diffused, and distributed shifts a little bit, and sometimes a lot, the idea of how information, what information is valued, and how we should think about, libraries, what is the role that they play, or how we should understand what are the possibilities through which business should organize and what kind of information should be relevant. So at the same time, there is a co-constitution in which different groups are coming and bringing their own perspectives to this territory, but building that and recreating it, so to speak.
I agree with that. And there are two things I like in the parts on the qualitative professions of the librarians. One where you see, you know, the forces within the librarian profession mid-19th century in the US, so we have to specify the setting here, how they try to expand their set of tasks that they have control over, and they wanted to go into, you know, also education and outreach. So not only preparing material for retrieval, this on page 218, but also defining what ought to be retrieved. But actually, it was the research libraries that were, the librarians were best organized there, and they had a very critical audience, namely us as academics. And we don't like them telling us what we should teach, or we just want them to do their work. And so kind of that educational and outreach effort kind of failed there. This is where you see kind of where sets of tasks become identified that are very near the set of tasks that the profession already does. And when it's kind of the same audience and nobody else covers them, then the profession can try to absorb those set of tasks and claim control. But then there are these internal dynamics between, you know, librarians serving general audience or the academic audience, and how well they're represented in their collective organizing bodies that then determines like what are the tasks. So that's one thing that I liked about the case and the librarians. And the other one is to think about, you know, what external influences shaped the profession. And it describes technological innovations, for instance, microfilm, the Rekordac process for microfilming, which they first perceived as being a big threat, but then actually expanded the profession in the end. And then the rise of the computers. But the biggest thing that impacted the profession was actually the Second World War, where there was an increasing demand for information professionals, as information became a key thing in the war. And I guess Tom can say much more about that.
Yeah, definitely. That was also sort of the launch point for a lot of the work on the quantitative side. But sticking with the qualitative side for an instant, when, you know, following the World War, you had the rise of the public library in the United States, which greatly shifted the state of the profession and who the profession was serving. We built, well, I don't know how many, but it was just, it was a, everybody suddenly started building public libraries in just about every town around that time. And it's, you know, so then the audience was shifting and the nature of the work shifted in kind, because then it wasn't the librarians serving other specialized professionals. They were servicing the public whose ordinary access to the library was very, you know, sporadic. It was also the school librarians that were also developing at that time, where each elementary school, middle school, high school was having their own library and therefore their own librarian. Now that, of course, you know, with that type of change in the professional work, it also significantly changed or created this sort of internal stratification, internal differentiation between what types of people, or excuse me, what were the skills necessary to work in a particular venue? And you know, so obviously there was the university librarians were considered higher end than, say, the school librarians, even though the diagnosis, inference, and treatment at its essence, the application of professional work was not actually all that much different. The context was what mattered.
And in a way, when you think about external events, you can also think about how COVID is having an impact on the information professions. You know, when we as academics cannot access the libraries ourselves anymore, we sometimes have to rely on librarians to find that information for us, digitize it. So, you know, what we've seen over the past couple of decades, and at least in Europe, but I'm sure in the US as well, is the decline of the librarian profession. Information profession in general. thinking that, you know, all of this can be automated and we can do this ourselves, and, you know, very low wages, very difficult for this profession to make a living. And now we see we're really relying on them, as we cannot access our offices anymore, to help us in executing our work.
Yeah, and at the same time, digitization, which was definitely not a thing back in when this book was written, is shaping a lot of that. Because, a lot of libraries are under tremendous pressure just due to cost, but also the inconvenience of it, of trying to move away from hard printed materials to digitized works. My institution right now is undergoing a major digitization project for all of its historical archives, which is going to take years. It's very costly, but it's ultimately going to make material available worldwide, as opposed to, you know, the current confines with the brick and mortar, where in a lot of ways, it sort of enhances the position of the librarian as the arbiter of the arbiter of the access to the information, because you have to physically go to the library and you're trying to figure out where everything is. Things that nowadays is a internet search that takes roughly a tenth of a second, you know, so it's very different.
So what I think, this is all super rich, but when I read, I think, the case, what struck me, and it's, you all touched on it in different ways, is that we start to see the importance of the workplace and the organizational dimension that exists in this story, which, I mean, Abbott is a sociologist, and he's a sociologist studying the professions, and he acknowledges and tries to bring some of the organization, but it's not his paramount focus. It is, however, ours, in the podcast, in our most of our work, right? So I think it's interesting that the case and some of our comments showcase a bit of how the workplace and the way that formal organizations function bring specific challenges. So one that being, just in reference to what Greta just said, on how the system of professions is not just one in which there is a proto battle around jurisdictions. In parallel to that, people are trying to get their work done. And in complex organizations, there is usually interdependencies across different groups, which are sometimes represented different professions. So the case of librarians and academics being one. And then the question becomes exactly not just, the question becomes not only who has a jurisdiction for the sake of it, but how in the different claims and settlements and debate, certain ways of working becomes possible and acceptable, certain ways of organizing take over or not. Because depending on what version of a profession takes over, or what profession takes over a particular position in the organization, we can have different consequences, you know. So imagine if the librarians had a bigger say in the way academic libraries are structured, would it be very different from the reality we have today? And Abbott shows that, you know, there was a point in which there was a fight for that, and the academics won the day, and the librarians kind of, you know, took over a more subordinate position, so to speak. But I think this is interesting because we, in the podcast, have discussed a lot of studies about work and professions and work organizations, and we have seen, and this is where Abbott gets at the second part of the chapter when he talks about engineers and accountants. You can very much see on how the emergence of these groups and the positions they took over in work organizations have made possible the advancement of some ideas that became taken for granted as the way organizations are run. The most exemplary one being exactly on how much mechanical engineers were almost synonymous to shop floor management and brought specific ideas to that, which were later challenges by the more psychological type of ideas from human relations, all of which we discussed in the podcast. Or even if you think about the professional groups that historically have had a bigger grasp, so to speak, in the executive suite, you know, from engineers, but later to more market type of people, and today maybe more type of design type of things that reflect different changes on what is perceived as central for the running of the organization and the accountability that it has. So I think that is the interesting thing that we start to see, and I think it answers our questions, you know, why it's important to study the professions, because they have a bigger say, and in these jurisdictional battles, they color differently the way the organizations operate and the relations that exist among the different workers that populate them.
I'm again thinking about the automation debate that's also mostly run by from an engineering view, from what is possible to automate, rather than if it's automatable, is that something that we want? And will people use it? For instance, when you think about, you know, the self-driving cars and inference, one thing you have to automate is when there's an accident, and, you know, there's no way out. You have to hit someone. Who are you going to hit? You know, there's an ethical thing that as people, we never came to a conclusion about that. We leave it up to the moment. So to make a decision about programming that into the technology, so here you also see that, you know, within those technology firms, which professions, which occupations are listen to the most in the executive suite, and also the internal organizing of professions within the organization. Where are they embedded in the organization? You know, when you think about current quantitative information professions, very dominant in companies are, for instance, data analysts, as well as data scientists. Data analysts are often embedded in finance, whereas data science is often in engineering. But the products the data scientists make are often part of the product that the company makes. So why is it not part of a product team? So and you see vastly different ways professions are organized within the organization. And this is like something that I've been fascinated by in terms of AI development. Like, which professions within the organization are involved, and where are they represented in the organization, and how does that matter? And I think, Pedro, this is like exactly like the lens as an organization scholar we would take to this, is to look at it like, okay, like how does that matter, and how well are they then also representing their profession? Does that have an impact? There are certain assumptions within the book about professions, when they are well organized, having a full say. But for instance, the organizational structure is one way the reach and the power over a task by a profession is limited. Another one that has become very dominant, when you think, for instance, about the US context, after the 1960s, full-time employment is not there anymore for many professions. So there is no speaking about the employment relationship now. And when you look at well-organized professions such as doctors or lawyers, either they are fully employed or they are independent, having a secure source of income. But when you think about art professions or writers, or when you think about, for instance, the technology profession, software engineers, they're often employed as contractors. And the bodies to collectively organize as a profession, they're often affiliated with trade unions, those types of bodies, and they only accept full-time employees. They see these independent ones as a threat to full-time employment, so they don't accept them. So that's the deterioration, the collective organizing of a profession, so where they have less say over how work happens within the organization, and where organizational structure actually gains dominance.
So if I understand correctly, now just to synthesize, I think that, and that is maybe one of my first critique of Abbott, or not critique, is the point that nobody can do everything. In a way the work is organized and the way the labor relations are organized are a little bit of a trigger for dynamics across professions. But as we know, it's not just that professions are embedded and enter the organization, but the very way in which they organize, or the very different possible labor regimes, add a different layer of all these dynamics already in itself.
I like your wording of labor regimes. Yeah.
we're continuing on with the thread of, organizing, and especially when it comes to talking about the artificial intelligence or machine learning now. You know, one of the things that I get concerned about, or I shouldn't say I put it that way, that I'm interested in is that when we think about how artificial intelligence shows the promise of being able to replicate inference, the inference step, to be, you know, because the obviously machines or computer, you know, modern day computers do have some advantages over the human brain if we can figure out how to program it correctly. But in a lot of ways, because of the way that the artificial intelligence field has gone, we actually, you know, when you do machine learning, it's an algorithm that basically captures successful decisions, okay, and millions upon millions of them over a very short period of time, in order to train a computer to come up with decisions that replicate that of an expert. But the thing about it is that it really is a black box. The interior of the, you know, the rules and the heuristics and stuff that are ultimately come from it are not analyzable, not in the way in which, say, in the old days of when Abbott was there, we could do interviews with experts and try to figure out what was the reasoning behind what you did. How did you decide that these particular symptoms would result in this diagnosis, which would then demand that particular treatment? The interior of a machine-learned box just simply doesn't have that quality to it. So, you know, on the one hand, the promise of artificial intelligence can be a bit overstated in a way that people can think of that as an engineered solution that allows us to cut loose from needing all of these experts who, by the way, because of the schooling, the associations, the specialized knowledge that they have to develop and cultivate, tend to be expensive, right? They tend to, they also tend not to be in huge numbers, you know, like they're not immediately accessible to everybody. And so then we go down this artificial intelligence realm. Well, then what happens is that at some point, you know, artificial intelligence is no less fallible, and it's dependent entirely about the conditions under which the database was built. We're going to reach the points where there's high risk associated with the learned inferences being horribly wrong, and then what? Because in a way, the reliance or the shift in reliance on these machine learned algorithms essentially means we have conditioned ourselves to think that we don't need the associated same amount of experts, real experts, and then that atrophies. I think back to a lot of what Ralph's has been saying in previous podcasts about his line of work in the Navy as an engineer and a technician, about what happens when a whole bunch of the older experts start walking out the door and the domain of knowledge goes walking out with it. You see what I mean?
So I have a counterpoint and an expansion. The counterpoint is I am not entirely sure if that the problem is, I mean, let's rephrase that. I'm not entirely sure that we can interview the experts and get to what the experts are doing. Because, and then, however, I think that is the further problem is that we know there is tacit knowledge. And we know there is always rationalization after you make a decision. There is all this process in the inference that is beyond just what the diagnosis you arrived at. Because all the things you discarded and the contextual knowledge and all that thing, that in principle, that's where experts have built their turf, so to speak, on, which is something that cannot be completely codified, identifiable, routinized. And what is, however, is concerning, and I agree with everything you said, is that it almost feels that this premise has completely eroded. And in a way, AI has brought a meta, has been able to, you know, to do one of the rhetoric moves that I would say is like a reduction of everything, and has been able to, is able to claim that everything can be subsumed under that, meaning that all the different varieties of work and problems and experts, this technology can cut across all of that and propose a different type of toolbox, so to speak. And so that's kind of interesting that in a way, it's something that it's a hegemony that I think was unthinkable when Abbott was writing, because he talks about the technology is very much still a tool in the hands of people. But given our mythical ideas about, you know, the possibilities of technology, maybe given the way in which technology has become a central force in organizations and a place in the economy and a specific small group of people, sometimes in a specific geographical place, like Silicon Valley has been able to push for the idea that the tools that are proposing can be a solution for all types of situations and places and bodies of knowledge, you know. So that is the shift that I think that is, you know, I wonder, Abbott is still alive, so I wonder if he's, you know, reflecting on that, because it seems that it is an expansion that is beyond this kind of dynamics he's documenting. It's a totalizing one, almost, or promises, or is discussed as is potentially being able to be that.
Now, this does bring up a couple of interesting points about, you know, when we were talking before about legitimacy. And I wholly agree, you know, there is a question about, okay, so let's say that we go this route and we continue with more and more machine learning applications and we rely less on human experts, is at what point does legitimacy erode, which one can argue is already going? And different from laicization, which Abbott mentions explicitly, which is essentially like we begin taking away autonomy from the professions and start diagnosing ourselves and things like that. There's also anti-professionalism or backlash against professionalism that we have to be thinking about, because, and it's not just machine learning, it is where the trust is breaking down between the professions and the professionals and the people being served. This is where legitimacy really, really goes wrong. And I think we're seeing some of that playing out as a result of the pandemic, correct?
So are you having a specific example in mind when you think about the pandemic?
How many? Which one?
Hundreds? Yeah. Well, there's two in particular that I think are very, very prominent in the media. And this is the public health sector, public health, which is a subset of medicine, and law enforcement. I'd like to tackle the public health one because I think that this is one that in a lot of ways is surprising perhaps, but I think it's sort of, you know, Abbott, through his model, offers a pretty good explanation without necessarily having to see what, you know, how things are transpiring. Because when we think about the whole medical domain of expert knowledge, where does public health reside in the internal hierarchy? Whatever reasons it is, you know, it's just basically has fallen to sort of the lower end, because, you know, when we think of medicine, okay, society, when we think of medicine, our first inkling is to think about the doctor who's in front of us curing us, or the hospital that the doctor is in. The public health is a very, very important sector of medicine that is largely invisible unless you have a pandemic or you have some other major societal threat. But because they focus on policy and very, very big, you know, it just isn't tangible to many people. And so then when a public health official speaks to us, we hear something different than what comes from our own doctor who we may be very familiar with. And so that legitimacy, the trust is, you know, that calculus is different. That in a lot of ways has put public health in a different light as we're going through the pandemic.
So this strikes me because it brings forward a feeling I had while reading the book, and especially I think the case study that you can see in the qualitative story of, you know, the changes across the librarians and the quantitative ones about the accountants and the engineers and so on. And you see how domains, so the jurisdiction, so problems of social life are continuously taken over and fought, and ideas are brought. And you see that very much, I mean, we know that, but I think it just becomes more analytically clear there is not one way to resolve issues like how we care for the sick or what we should do regarding the role of business in society. In what ways are they accountable for whom? which, you know, it showcases that there is no wizard behind the curtain, so to speak. You know, it is a product of these different groups that bring their specific ideas, and there becomes naturalized in a number of ways. As you are saying, we think of medicine as something that is more based on a pill for every ill type of situation. And we know that real medicine is about a collective effort, and it's much more about primary care and making sure that you prevent, if anything, than just, you know, remediation of sick people. But unfortunately, the way certain groups take over, the way certain ideas become completely collapse, in the case of medicine is perhaps the most clear one. You collapse a particular perspective and occupational body of knowledge into the problem itself to the point that it becomes almost unthinkable of an alternative. And I think that is one of the powers of the book, beyond our own concerns as organizational researchers, is to see how the way that we structure society at large and the role of organizations in them actually is a fruit of a continuous, perpetual Abbott disclaims in terms of a conflict, but we can also think of terms of perpetual attempts to resolve and bring solutions and ideas to this type of problems, which actually also is empowering because it opens up the possibility to say, how could this be different if it was not always like this? And I think this is the strength of this kind of analysis. How can you build it differently? You know, what would make us to think of business is not just in terms of cost and benefit, short-term analysis, as have been constructed and sedimented through a series of bodies of knowledge coming from accountants and so on and so forth. And we've included the whole issue about this sustainability and the environment that was not put in the bookkeeping in the early days and is now being recognized as a huge externality basis, you want to call it whatever you want, or things like public health that has been excluded for so long. And now we see the importance of these kind of issues when a major systemic breakdown happens.
So my question there is, to what extent is this the result of the battle of the professions in its current state? Or to what extent is this an illness of capitalism? Anyone wants to respond? Because this is what Abbott also acknowledges, like, everything he describes is taking place in a capitalist system.
So that is a good thing, because I think that's the other that's the other aspect of the book that I had some... Again, this is already encyclopedic and biblical in proportions. But, I mean, the story is told in a way that some of the elements are almost naturalized, even though Abbott tries to go beyond them. So, for example, the idea that this battle is taking place apparently in a capitalist relation, I would add that a type of capitalism in which the market is so prominent and the state seems to be very minor. And you can see that because he tries to bring a lot of examples and discussions on how the things play out a bit different in continental Europe or in France, where the state has a bigger say, and how the battle is you know, fought in front of the courts, not just in the public arena, so on and so forth. So one wonders, what does it happen in a situation where there is less of this perpetual individualistic type of almost self-serving type of threat, and more in a situation in which there is a broader sense of collective goals and collective and consequences of one way to the other? You know, it is in a way very telling that I think what he describes is particularly visible in a place like the US. I mean, the world is capitalist nowadays, and you know, you can go to any corner and these things would play out similarly. But I think it's particularly violent, we can say, or it's particularly individual-based or short-termed or self-serving in those conditions.
I'd like to move restate it, as opposed to saying capitalistic. But simply saying, you know, taking Abbott's examples of how the experience of the United States and Britain were different from the continent, and sort of laying that out on somewhat of a spectrum, because I think that's where a lot of these sort of discussions reside. So in the United States, where you just have a natural tension between centralized control and decentralized control. You know, it's basically the federal system versus the state system, which it's been rooted in American history, and we covered that in the Federalist Papers back in episode 43, which represents basically two completely different ways of thinking about the same problem. We apply that to what's going on with the perceptions of public health, and it sort of fits very well with the way that that tension plays out naturally in a lot of arenas, and especially with medicine, because you do have on the one side, you do have concerns about the ability to retain professional autonomy and the ability to, say, develop new techniques, develop new medicines, etc., which is largely requires less state involvement. I shouldn't say require, but is generally fostered by less state involvement and more autonomy among the profession. And then the other side, which is, you know, we want to make sure that everybody gets access to everything. I mean, we should have the access to services should be more universal, which becomes economically challenging and presents, it also puts different pressures on organizations to be able to conduct professional work. And I'm not saying that either is better than the other. We are constantly in a constructive and sometimes not so constructive dialogue about a synthesis between those two perspectives, just as we are in just about everything. So then, you know, the question comes down to, at any given time, which way is the policy leaning? I guess would be a good way to kind of put it. And in the present situation, you know, the crisis is going to increase the tension, which is going to increase the desire for movement towards one direction or another to say that we got to get out of this crisis. And I think that's what I kind of see. So I didn't want to get into the capitalistic side because I think that sort of thing would be independent of economic models so much as it is really just an ongoing tension about what do we think is the right way to just generally operate as a society.
So I had one thing that I wanted to say that it goes back to what Catherine said. Maybe she wants to say something, which is, I'm not a practitioner, I'm a full academic, but in a way, I had the same feeling while reading the book, especially the early chapters in which Abbott laid down the tools of the trade, you know, so how this fight is done and what is the elements that exist and what are the historically have been the consequences of the use of some of them in certain conditions. And I was thinking to myself about my own profession as an organizational researcher, as academic faculty, and as a social scientist, you know. And that is something that I usually reflect on because I feel that the different disciplines are also in a perpetual struggle in who gets to explain what and what is the value of specific bodies of knowledge. So not maybe so much in terms of the applicability, but certain what is the value of certain ways of, you know, understanding certain problems. You know, the clear example is economics, on how among the social sciences they have been certainly the queen in terms of their influence and their reach of certain ways of, you know, dissecting and certainly diagnosing, perhaps also in terms of inference and treatment. So that makes me wonder, you know, we can do the same kind of relation in terms of, you know, sustainability I was talking about and how scientists, I think there is Jennifer Howard Granville has an interesting paper, a recent one, on how chemists, I think, have molded their occupation in order to include concerns about sustainability within them. And so I think that the book, funny enough, and I agree with Catherine, brings this possibility of being able to act on what is the way the certain ideas through which society lives by and what groups get to have a say on that and how much specific professional groups are able to, you know, have their voice heard in this arena, you know. So I wouldn't know what to do with social sciences or organizational research, you know. I wish I have a more clear battle plan, so to speak. or for that matter, the role of sustainability or public health, which I think is extremely important and undervalued. But I think that the book, if anything, provides as a platform to think of different ways to organize and to, you know, shift some of our taken for granted ideas on how to resolve core and essential social issues.
A big thumbs up. We just need a Harvard Business Review paper version of chapter 1 to 4, I think, for the professions.
If I could say just in terms of a criticism, as you probably realized, I quite enjoyed this book. It is biblical, both in size and in content. But I really enjoyed the historical context that came with the case studies as well. You know, and I did read all of them because I enjoy history anyway. And there was elements of real descriptive flow that is, again, was quite unexpected. And, you know, there was really some amazing moments where I was just kind of scooped up into this amazing case story. Particularly, I enjoyed the personal problems jurisdiction, which isn't the focus of our discussion today. But what I think is really missing is, where is the updated version of this? You know, I really want Abbott to have be working on it at the moment, or in recent years have attempted to update it in terms of the information professions, which, as discussed this evening, I think, you know, is rich with, you know, relevant discussion and debate about what a professional is and how it might look like in the future. In fact, is it actually redundant entirely as a concept? I think currently the pandemic and the medical profession, like, it's really interesting what Tom said about public health versus medicine itself. There's so many threats to that jurisdiction, I think, at the moment, because of the element of the public arena. You know, the exposure that we're getting to public health in a way that we don't normally do is quite exposing of them. And that is referenced by Abbott about the workplace and what goes on behind the scenes and the fuzzy reality of what goes on, which is far more exposed when it's on national television once a day, as we have in the UK, representatives of public health, and as other countries have as well. I think that's really interesting. I think the legitimacy of medicine, you know, I know there is potentially a vaccine in Oxford, but, you know, will that work? Will others work? Will they be found? And who will encroach on that? And, you know, I can't help but think, and bringing in the personal problems jurisdiction, will there be some encroachment, which we saw during lockdown, from, you know, different areas of personal problems jurisdiction, which may encroach even from yoga, well-being, wellness, how that encroaches on people. Will medicine lose its legitimacy if it doesn't find a vaccine? You know, I'm sure it won't totally, because it takes a lot more than that to change a system. But there may be encroachments, and there may be little jurisdictional battles in the margins that change how certain professions are in the future, if indeed they are professions. And I think it would be really interesting to watch. So I'd like to just kind of fast forward ahead, if I could, in the future of all this, in a futurist way, to see, you know, what could all of this look like for professions in 2030, in 2050. I think it's fascinating.
Well, from what I learned from Abbott, I think that the future is ours to build. That is the power of understanding that, you know, it's dynamic, it's conflictual, and it's processual, so it's open-ended in a good and, you know, scary way sometimes as well.
Yeah, the scary way is definitely. Well, I'm laughing because in a lot of ways, you know, it's not just a matter of the threats or the challenges that are that professions face in terms of their control over knowledge. It's also over control of the narrative. And this is the part where I think if I were to look for an Abbott 2, that I think would be the most interesting, is the impact of not just the individual's access to the knowledge, but the individual's ability to just monitor what the profession is doing, the creation of expectations regarding what a profession can and cannot do that may very well stretch credulity. It's an aspect of the pressures on professions that I don't think were really there 30, 35 years ago when Abbott wrote this book, but I think is going to be really critical if, for example, we do want to look to certain segments of society to own and function in expert knowledge that just simply is not available or is not accessible to the average human being, where we have to turn to specific segments of society to provide us with services that just simply can't be provided in any other way. If the trust breaks down entirely between the idea of professions and the rest of society, then I think we have something to be worried about. And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Audner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberto Bernardi, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Peaks Kraft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lamas. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.